Welcome. Hola. Bienvenidos. Bonjour et bienvenue to the Social Network Show. Welcome to the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. We give you actionable information to make your social networking the best it can be for business to business, business to consumer, and for folks who just like to post. And now, broadcasting from the studios of the Hank Greenspoon School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nico, and Dr. Jane Kawaski.
Welcome to the National Crime Prevention Council series on the Social Network Show. I'm your host, Dr. Jane Karawoski, experimental psychologist. My co-host on the series is Michelle Boykins, Senior Director of Communications of the Washington, D.C. nonprofit, our National Crime Prevention Council. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you, Dr. Jay. So today, I'm pleased to introduce our guest, Wendy Melillo. She's the author of How McGruff and the Crying Indians Changed America. And she's also an associate professor of public communication at American University. Previously, she was a reporter for the Washington Post, where she received an award from the White House Correspondents Association and a nomination for a Pulitzer Prize. Her work has revolved around public service advertising, and she has spent almost a decade covering political advertising. Wendy is currently teaching at the School of Communications Strategic Communications Division at American University. And as we approach McGruff's 35th anniversary this year, it's fitting to talk to Wendy about her book, because 35 years ago, this month in 1980, McGruff's first commercial appeared on the air. And Wendy dedicated an entire chapter to McGruff and the beginning of the Take a Bite Out of Crime public education campaign. So welcome to the Social Network Show, Wendy.
Thank you so much for having me on today.
And I'm very happy to welcome you also, Wendy. I think McGruff has always seemed to be about 35 years old to me, although not in dog years, of course. He has certainly been an all-time success story for NCPC and the Ad Council. We all hear the Ad Council mentioned at the end of many public service announcements or advertisements. But Wendy, to introduce us to the topic, can you explain a bit what the Ad Council is and how it works?
Yes, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book. The Ad Council does not have a high public profile for its own name. It puts its campaigns out in front, and you see the logo appearing at the end of a public service spot that it has sponsored.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the Ad Council is a nonprofit organization based in New York City. And it is unique in that it acts as a go-between between a client, if you will, which could be a nonprofit organization or it could be the federal government, who requests a campaign, and the ad agencies who actually prepare the work. The Ad Council keeps a roster of some 50 advertising agencies, some of the top ones in the country, on its roster, and it pulls from these ad agencies to help prepare the work. It is considered an expert in that it has been involved in public service advertising, since the organization began in 1942, which takes us back to World War II days. But it also evaluates the campaigns as well. It charges a price for the campaigns, which at the time I wrote the book was anywhere from $2.4 million to $3 million, which is considered a hefty fee for much smaller nonprofits who might not be able to afford that kind of entrance fee.
Right. That does sound... Now, it's a nonprofit providing a service to other nonprofits, but the fee is quite considerable. So how does that work out in the finances of it?
Well, in terms of finances, the Ad Council takes in money from its nonprofit clients, but it also takes in taxpayer money from the federal government when it works with the federal government to prepare a campaign. And it uses this money to pay for its overhead costs, because there is no charge by the ad agencies to prepare the campaign. But there are, of course, production costs, considerable production costs in putting these kinds of campaigns together. Plus, the Ad Council keeps a staff, and it has overhead, office space, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So the finances are quite interesting, and I get into them in depth in the first chapter of the book, which is called What is the Ad Council?
Okay, and the book is called How McGruff and the Crying Indian Changed America. First of all, I want to ask, the PSA, you know, I've always thought that that stood for public service announcement, but I've been hearing public service advertisement. Which is correct, and is there, you know, some slight difference in the nuance there?
I just think people use the names interchangeably, but at the end of the day, it is an advertisement. It is an advertisement that is dedicated to public service, so it has a particular definition in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
But people also call them announcements because an announcement is being made. But in reality, there's a lot of advertising practice and strategy that goes into the preparation of these campaigns.
Now, is that
so
part
really
of... Is that part of what compelled you to write a book about the Ad Council and nonprofit campaigns?
The Ad Council was my beat when I was the D.C. Bureau Chief for Adweek magazine. And in fact, it was my favorite beat. I always regarded this as advertising that could make a difference in people's lives. This was not very dramatically different from selling soap, laundry,
mm-hmm.
detergent, or car. Okay, it's not product advertising. This was the kind of advertising that is meant to increase awareness about societal problems, to get people to change their behavior. So I was always fascinated by this. And in many ways, I believed the mom, apple pie, and Americana image of the Ad Council because it very much gives out that public image.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of some of its campaigns, that's absolutely well-deserved. And we'll get into discussing McGruff, and I will say why McGruff deserves the good reputation that it has. But that's not necessarily the case with other Ad Council campaigns, which was one of the surprises that I found in my research, because as a journalist, I'm supposed to know my beat.
Mm-hmm.
But we only do kind of the surface reporting, as you know, because we have daily deadlines and
right.
weekly deadlines, and so we don't get into things in depth, which would one of the reasons why I love having a job at a university, because it allows me to delve down deeply into one topic, which I was able to do. But I think in my research, I think even the Ad Council staff, which was not familiar with all of its history, was surprised by some of my findings.
Ah, well, Jim and I are well acquainted with McGruff teaching us how we can help each one of us take a bite out of crime. But I'm embarrassed to say that I drew a blank on the crying Indian. Before we go on, can you tell us briefly, since that's part of your title, who the crying Indian refers to?
Oh, that's an iconic and very memorable campaign from 1970 that featured an allegedly Cherokee Indian who paddles a canoe up an increasingly polluted river. He gets out of his canoe. He walks on the beach. Someone who's driving by on the highway throws a bag of garbage out at his feet. It's an anti-littering as well as an anti-pollution campaign. That's basically part of an organization called Keep America Beautiful, which is the sponsoring nonprofit, which requested the campaign of the Ad Council. Its work with the Ad Council actually goes back to the 1960s, but everyone remembers the Crying Indian campaign because that's the one that won all of the awards.
Uh-huh.
It is the most controversial campaign that I've had in the book,
mm-hmm.
and I found it one of the most fascinating because when you think of public service, you don't think of special interests.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found in this campaign is the driving force of the sponsoring organization, Keep America Beautiful, which sounds like a lovely, wonderful name. It sounds like the Sierra Club, right? Your
mm-hmm.
grassroots environmental organization or the National Audubon Society or something.
But who is it really?
No. It's the packaged goods manufacturers in this country.
Huh.
And a lot of the research and the controversy centered around they want to focus exclusively on an anti-littering campaign because they are far less interested in getting us to be able to have deposits on our soda pop bottles to return them. And it's packaged good manufacturing like Glad baggies and McDonald's packaging.
Oh, so they are the ones
PepsiCo who... PepsiCo bottles that take a one... plastic bottles that take a one-way trip from manufacturing into the garbage stream, and that's it.
Okay, so they were the ones manufacturing all that litter. And I'm sure that the Native American community had some issues, too, with, I believe it was Iron Eyes Cody that was the actor.
That turned out to be a fiasco as well, because the actor portrayed himself as a Native American, specifically a Cherokee. The ad agency deliberately wanted a Native American, because think about what's happening in American history at the time. We have Earth Day in the early 70s. We have the birth of the Environmental Protection Agency. And so this, the whole ad centered around the Native American crying over the loss of the pristine land.
Mm.
Well, Iron Eyes Cody turned out to be none other than Emilio Esperanza de Corti, an Italian.
Oh, no.
Which is one of the funnier, bizarre things that was very much a public relations crisis for Keep America Beautiful, the Ad Council, etc., when it was later revealed that he was not the Native American that he was allegedly portrayed to be in the ad, which won all of these advertising awards.
Oh, my gosh.
So, I mean, who knew this stuff? Who knew this stuff?
Well, that alone, it makes me want to read the whole book. It's probably, I think, one of your themes to get people to think about what is behind advertising and motivations and why do people want to get us to do X, Y, or Z? Well, I have lots of other questions.
One of the things I found fascinating about the Ad Council, just to follow up very briefly on your thought there, is think about what Ad Council campaigns do. They focus only on the individual actions we as Americans can take to solve some of society's more complex problems.
Not the industries or the corporations.
Corporations, the federal government. These are complex problems where we all need to work together. But their campaigns only focus on individual actions, and really that's not the total blame of the Ad Council. It has to do with being able to get those ads on the air and the network wanting to offend their advertisers.
Oh, so it's
really a much more complex story than people realize.
Well, this is really fascinating, Wendy. I'm looking forward to getting more of the inside scoop on your book in the second half of the show. You're listening to The Social Network Show. I'm Dr. Jane Karwoski, and coming up, we'll have more with Wendy Melillo, author of How McGruff and the Crying Indian Changed America.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
As internet technology advances, so does the threat of cybercrime. And the instant you go online, you become vulnerable to dangers such as identity theft, computer viruses, phishing, spyware, and more. In times like these, we must all protect ourselves from cybercrime. Antivirus software, firewalls, and security patches are just the beginning. Never open suspicious emails, only navigate to trusted sites, and change your passwords every 90 days. Backup important files to external storage devices. Tell anyone who uses your computer to be vigilant when downloading from the internet. Keep your kids safe on the internet. Teach them never to give out personal information or post information about their school or extracurricular activities. Installing parental control software and monitoring their computer are all good ways to prevent cybercrime. To learn more about cybercrime, visit ncpc.org or contact your local law enforcement agency.
A message from the U.S. Department of Justice, National Crime Prevention Council, and the Ad Council.
Now, back to the Social Network Show.
Welcome back to the Social Network Show. I'm Dr. Jane Karwoski with my co-host, Michelle Boykins, and we are speaking with Wendy Melillo, author of How McGruff and the Crying Indian Changed America, who is eminently qualified to talk about the effects of public service advertising on our nation's history and future.
Hey, Wendy, I have a quick question for you about your background. Did you always have a passion for journalism and communication?
Yes. In fact, I was one of those students who was so inspired by Watergate. But I have to say, I did not come to American University, and I have to say American University is my alma mater as well as my current employer. I did not come for journalism. I came for international relations. But I quickly figured out that I didn't have a very diplomatic personality. I often spoke my mind, and I was really better suited to journalism than diplomacy. And so I double majored, and the rest is history.
Well, you know, I think that the book is just so fascinating, and, you know, there's so much good stuff in there. And obviously, I work in this field and, know a lot about what you covered regarding public service advertising campaigns. But was there anything that you would have liked to have explored more or that you wish you could have included that you weren't able to get into the book?
Oh, absolutely. The Ad Council since 1942 has done more than 400 campaigns. And the idea was to try to at least hit on a major campaign or an interesting campaign a decade. And the Peace Corps from 1960 is noticeably absent, much to my frustration. The Vince and Larry crash dummies for buckle-ups, you know, for seatbelts is absent. The Freedom Campaign following September 11th attacks is absent. And it's just, we all have deadlines, and we always want to do more than, you know, we think we can by the deadline. But I was very close on Peace Corps and was very disappointed and have absolute plans to pursue that. There are other ways to publish in terms of articles and et cetera, but I don't think the book is totally complete. I only scratched the surface of the Ad Council campaigns.
Well, in talking about McGruff, in your opinion, did the timing of the McGruff campaign, it was in the 70s during a hostile, heavily violent time in the United States, do you think that contributed to McGruff's almost instant acceptance?
It was the number one issue on the public's mind, crime. Okay, so that certainly played a huge role. I also think the fact that it was an animated character patterned after Peter Falk in Columbo, which was a very popular television detective show at the time,
mm-hmm.
The combination of those two made it extremely appealing to people. And what's important to note about this campaign, unlike many of the other Ad Council campaigns, it was assessed by outside independent experts. An academic spent extensive time measuring the effectiveness using social science techniques of this campaign. You don't see that with a lot of ad council campaigns, and that's simply because academics may not have the money to raise a grant, as in the case of the academic who wrote the book about, you know, the success, the effectiveness of McGrath. But that's really important to outsiders because, you know, people can say, yeah, these are really great and these are really effective, but where's the scientific evidence to back that up?
Right, evaluation. Evaluation is often the missing piece.
I agree. And with McGrath, we actually had some good social science research to hang our hats on that this really worked in terms of what it intended to do. And that's, I think, an important distinction. In fact, it's the only campaign in the book that actually had this kind of outside evaluation done.
Oh, wow. Well, do you have a favorite McGrath PSA?
Oh, I'm going to go with, I think, Stop a Crime, the first one, only because every time I see it, some images flash in my mind. One is the fact that, you know, McGrath is sniffing the cookies because he actually couldn't take a cookie. That would make it look like he was, you know, not only breaking and entering, but he was, like, stealing property. They were able to get over the hump with the breaking and entering because McGrath actually enters the home. But he sniffs the cookies instead of actually, you know, biting one into one.
Showing remarkable self-restraint. I wish my dog had that.
Yes, exactly. But from an advertising perspective, when you think about how it's put together, you've got to go through all of these pieces. And then one of the people involved from the ad agency that I just loved interviewing was Sherry Nemers. She talked about how she had to put her arm up. You know, it's her arm in there that's locking the door at the end of the spot. And the take after take, it's something like 11 takes just to get it right. You know, it's like, who would think it would be so hard to lock a door, right? And so it's just those stories behind it, knowing that, just makes that spot endearing. But also, it's incredibly effective because McGrath is taking it from someone who could break into your house. And what are some of the things you can do? Well, you could leave your lights on if you're not home. You could have somebody pick up your newspapers. These were little, simple, effective things that people could do. And that's what that spot, you know, kind of portrays, the whole essence of the campaign and the messaging.
Well, you know, Wendy, I happen to love her character. I love hearing you talk, you know, more about McGrath. And, you know, in the chapter, you spend a lot of time talking to a lot of people about McGrath and about our campaign. But, you know, I wondered if, as you were listening to people and their accounts of what happened, you know, back in the 60s and the end of the 70s, you know, was a huge concern with crime. And do you think that an earlier introduction of McGrath, who really empowered the public to get involved in crime prevention, do you think that could have helped decrease crime a little bit earlier in the 70s?
I think these campaigns are actually rooted in their cultural and historical moment, if you will. I think they are created in response to a need at the time. And yes, McGrath could have been created earlier, but would it have taken on the kind of interest and success it did if that wasn't the number one topic in public opinion polls that Americans were concerned about? And so I think a lot of this has to do with what is the right moment? What is the campaign responding to? And I think that showed up in the evaluation of the campaign, because it was so top of mind for Americans at that moment, this was the right timing, if you will, for the campaign.
You know, another aspect to that is that at that time, everyone was listening to the radio, watching the television, the three big TV networks. Basically, were the whole thing. But what about now? Now that those media are perhaps in somewhat of an eclipse, people are much more listening to the internet or watching the internet news and so forth. It's much more diverse and scattered. Where do we go now to reach the public when there's no longer seems to be a way of reaching everyone at one fell swoop?
This is one of the debates I had with Ad Council staff in the book, and it's, you know, basically two very different opinions. Today, it's all about digital media. So it's online in many respects, mm-hmm. or it's Twitter, social media, you know, Facebook. My fundamental question is, if you were starting today, could you create a Smokey Bear or a McGruff? Starting from scratch, and have those images rise to the kind of memorable status where they have become embedded in our culture the way these two characters have. Could you do it solely in digital media, with the internet and social media? And so a very fair comment and response by the Ad Council is, look, Wendy, it's not about that anymore. We're no longer in a world of three major networks, where mm-hmm. 90% of the audience is watching. We are now in a very fragmented media landscape. So if I reach one person with my message online, and that's the person whose behavior I need to change, that's all that matters. I don't know. I think you need kind of the visibility and, mm-hmm. you know, to get to overuse of the word iconic status, to get it embedded in our culture, to get these slogans on lips generation after generation.
Mm.
And I'm not sure. I worry now about relevancy. What is the relevancy of the Ad Council in the 21st century? And that's a very important question.
Right. They would need to do some major refashioning, you might say. I'm thinking of how things can go viral. I mean, that's basically one thing. And it's more of a time-limited thing. So I agree with you. The issue of something iconic to where it is an entire generation is familiar with it. An entire world might be familiar with it in a moment or for a day or a few days with something that goes viral. But yeah, you raise a really good question there.
And I try to explore that a little in the epilogue of the book, but there's much more to be said on that topic.
Well, we will look forward to that. Thank you so much, Wendy, and for coming on the show and talking to us about your book, How McGruff and the Crying Indian Changed America. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on. It was good fun.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And thank you for being my co-host again, Michelle Boykins of the National Crime Prevention Council, and for bringing Wendy Melillo, the author, on the show today.
I appreciate your time, and thank you, Wendy. It was great.
Okay.
You can find more information about Wendy Melillo and the book at howmcgruffchangedamerica.com. And thank you for listening, our guest and most important listener and guest. Please mention to your social networks, online and off, that you enjoy the show, and please visit our webpage, thesocialnetworkshow.com, and add us to your playlist on iTunes or podcast1.com. Please have fun and be safe online and off until we meet you here again.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media, coming to you from the studios of the Hank Greenspan School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on The Social Network Show are those of the hosts and guests and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.